Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
Russell Nelson, president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, died last Saturday. He was 101. He was 93 when he took on the role, and people weren't really expecting the church would enter this era of remarkable change. His wife said he had been unleashed, and sure enough, he got right to work revising church programs and recentering its focus. The historian Benjamin Park said Nelson embraced the role of LDS prophet as being charismatic and transformational. He was a reformer, Park says. He was a peacemaker, and of course, he was a temple builder.
Among the 200 temples that Russell M. Nelson announced during his presidential tenure was the Rome, Italy temple that was dedicated in March 2019. There had been rumors about this temple for decades, but due to the number of circumstances that often are related to temples in big and important cities, this one was long delayed, but it was finally dedicated on Russell M. Nelson's watch. This was, in many ways, the LDS Church's entrance into the global community of Christendom, given the significance of the city of Rome. Perhaps recognizing that significance, Russell Nelson decided to fly the entire First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles to Rome. Now, this is rare. I can't think of another temple in recent history that featured multiple LDS apostles and First Presidency members, let alone all of them. As part of the dedication festivities, they all gathered in the new visitor center next to the temple. Inside that visitor center is a large Christus statue, the same statue that you find in the Salt Lake City Temple Visitor Center, and the same Christus image that is now a part of the church's official logo. The entire church leadership then took a picture in front of that Christus and the 12 statues that surround the Christus that represent Jesus Christ's own apostles. They are in the center of Christendom, in front of these images of the Christian tradition representing the modern restoration. That image on its own, I think, carries a lot of weight. But even more than that, the church also released an image of Russell M. Nelson, the president and prophet of the faith, standing next to the statue of Saint Peter. That statue, as Saint Peter holding a key that represents Christ giving Peter and the apostles authority for after he died, something that's referenced in the New Testament of upon this rock I will build my church, the rock being Peter. And in this photograph with the statue of Peter holding the key is Russell M. Nelson also holding the key, proving this connection that converges these two centuries of history and priestly authority. I find that image so revealing because it shows Russell M. Nelson embraced the image of a charismatic and consequential prophetic authority and this message of restoration and priesthood authority at the center of his vision for the global LDS church.
That's the historian Benjamin Park. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Russell Nelson and how he reshaped the church in ways few expected. We have with us throughout the rest of the hour the journalist and historian Jana Rees. She's a senior columnist for Religion News Service. Patrick Mason is a professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. And we have with us Matthew Bowman. He's an assistant professor of religion and history and chair of the Mormon Studies program at Claremont Graduate University. Where did Russell M. Nelson fit with other LDS church presidents? I mean, you had presidents who had, you know, remarkable longevity and vision. You had presidents with a kind of charisma and public presence. You had others who were just kind of placeholders, didn't last very long because of their age, didn't seem to make much of a, you know, dent in the larger scheme of things. Where does Russell M. Nelson fit? Jana Reese, you begin with that question for us.
I think that time will tell, but my understanding of it in this particular historical moment is that everyone was surprised by what an energetic president he has been and how much change he initiated into the daily lives of members of the church all around the world. That was not necessarily something that people were expecting of a 93-year-old coming into this role. I would say particularly because as an apostle, I could not have associated him with any particular cause or movement or ideology. I went back after his death through many of his general conference talks and, you know, they emphasized classic themes.
Yeah. But you didn't see anything in those speeches that seemed to track a grand vision that he had in mind for the church or anything
like
that?
Well, if you go back and you can see certain themes. I mean, he gave a talk about peacemaking decades ago that was a precursor of the much more famous peacemaking initiative that he started within the church. And he also, in 1990, famously spoke about emphasizing the correct name of the church, which was then, in the following general conference, a little bit de-emphasized by President Hinckley, which almost never happens in general conference. So that was kind of an interesting development. President Hinckley did that very tactfully, but he was committed to the continued use of the word Mormon.
Matthew Bowman, what about you?
Yeah, I would echo Jana in some ways. It's surprising is a good word here. We all expected, I think, that his tenure would be routine and probably short, given his age. He also, I think, seemed to me, well, Jana says, you know, he seemed not to stand out very much, but I would say, like, theologically, he was very much representative, I think, of the era in which he grew up, which was an era of pretty significant theological conservatism, influenced by leaders like Bruce R. McConkie, Joseph Fielding Smith. Nelson was always, for instance, an opponent of the theory of evolution. And he embraced, I think, this very kind of classical mid-20th century form of the faith, which emphasized conservative ideas and this notion of effort, of, you know, thinking celestial, right, which is one of his big themes, like try harder, work harder, do better. That is the kind of faith that many, I think, people a generation or two younger than him were just marinated in and grew up not even noticing. It was the water they all swam in. And I think because of that, because he seemed so conventional and so traditional, it was then surprising again that he really, I think, as leader of the church, began to envision a church very different than the one he grew up in. And I would emphasize over and over and over, I think so many of his changes were designed with an eye to a church that was no longer predominantly American, a church that left behind, I think, a lot of the preoccupations and ideas surrounding religion in the United States. And he pivoted hard to the global South in a lot of procedural ways that I think many Americans did not necessarily recognize because some of these changes were not directed at them.
Patrick Mason, what about you?
Yeah, if you asked us to kind of place him in the kind of grand sweep of other Latter-day Saint prophets, that he's certainly not a Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, but nobody else is. I mean, those two are really singular figures. But so if we go beyond that, I see him in a lot of ways similar to the first two presidents of the church in the 20th century, Joseph F. Smith and Heber J. Grant. But they really oversaw a transition of the church from one age into another. In their case, from the 19th century into the 20th century, from a pioneer church into something like a modern church. And I think President Nelson, I think he's going to be remembered as a transitional figure in terms of helping the church think about what it means to be a 21st century church. I think the globalism that Matt mentioned is a big part of that. But really thinking about what does it mean to bring energy and vitality into an institution and not simply do things the way we've been doing them for the past few decades for the sake of doing them that way.
Hmm. Where did Russell M. Nelson seem to be coming from? And by that I mean, I guess let's start with sort of religiously or spiritually. I mean, he was a physician. He was a surgeon. But was he also a theologian? Did you get a sense that he had, aside from his obvious devotion to the church, did he have a particular theme spiritually that came through, I suppose? Patrick?
It's a good question. I think if you look at his talks over the years, they do cover a whole range of topics. He wasn't a type of guy to just kind of beat the same drum over and over again. Even over the course of his presidency, he hit a number of themes, and he did so with clarity and with resonance. But he wasn't just a one-note prophet. I mean, even if you think about some of the taglines or the prominent things that he did speak about, there were several of them: covenant path, gathering of Israel, temple building, peacemaking, think celestial. I mean, there were several of these. It wasn't just kind of a single theme that went throughout. So I think my sense of him, he often spoke about how much time he spent in the scriptures. He wasn't a theologian in the sense of, I don't think he reveled in speculative ideas or how can we advance the way we think about it. I think he was a person very tied to what he saw as Orthodox Church doctrine and what he found in the scriptures. He quoted the scriptures constantly. He talked about the language in the scriptures and what it meant. I think he was a person for whom daily scripture study really informed the way he thought about it. And of course, if you read Latter-day Saint scriptures, there's hundreds and, you know, thousands of pages of them that cover a whole range of topics. So I think that is who President Nelson was. He was interested in the totality of the religion, all of the themes that are presented there. And he picked out a handful of major themes. But that's the way that scripture works, too. So in a lot of ways, that's how I saw him, as sort of thinking broadly about the religion along with the scriptural tradition.
If I might add, though, to what Patrick says there, I think that's really true, right? I think Nelson was someone who, while he was not really immersed, I think, in theology, in people even in the Latter-day Saint tradition who write theology, he certainly was someone who thought a lot about the raw material of his faith. But I do think, right, that there were some themes there. And I think, as I said before, these are themes that emerged from the version of the faith that he grew up in. That is to say, a version of the faith that was really optimistic about human potential, about our ability to get things right if we just try really hard. I think you see that in the notion of thinking celestial, right, of every day, kind of think about what it would mean to go to heaven and what you have to do to get there. You see that in the idea of the covenant path, and this idea of making one covenant that then builds onto another covenant, right? He was not, for instance, part of what I think is an emerging movement in the church that increasingly is emphasizing the grace of Jesus Christ. Instead, right, his version of the faith was that came out of the early and mid 20th century, that was simultaneously really optimistic about humanity, but also then could be, I think, for some people, felt like a real burden when you put all those sorts of expectations on people and say, just do this, just do this, just do this, and you'll eventually get there. For some people, the just do this of it becomes rather burdensome. And for some people, it's really optimistic and hopeful. And he was, I think, ultimately an optimistic and hopeful person. He wasn't dour. He wasn't scowling. And I think that really came through while he was president of the church. There was a kind of an almost exuberant joy about him that I think wasn't necessarily evident when he was a prophet or before he became a prophet. But afterward, right, that came through in how vigorously he urged members of the church to follow the teachings that he was giving them.
You know, I would echo a lot of what you both have just said. Matt, you mentioned earlier the emphasis on personal effort in President Nelson's theology. If you look in the General Conference Index, for example, you look up the word qualify. A lot of times that qualify has been used in General Conference came from Elder and President Nelson. And that is something that he consistently emphasized. And, you know, I think the tension, as Matt pointed out, is that for many people, that's optimistic and exciting, because if you put in the effort and if you do the right things and if you say the right prayers and you read your scriptures daily, you will have good results. For other people, it feels like a burden, especially if they don't necessarily receive the promised result.
When Russell M. Nelson became president, a few months after this, it was almost a year, his wife Wendy said this thing that became kind of famous. She said, "It's as though he's been unleashed." And a lot of people made a lot of that. And of course, depending on where you were coming from, you made a lot of that. And I wondered what you all made of that question. Another thing she had mentioned was he's not interested in fitting inside a box. He likes to think outside of the box. So what was she getting at there? What did that say about what might be coming for Russell M. Nelson in terms of change within this church? Jana, you first.
Well, I have no data with which to back this up, but in my mind, I see him for three decades or more as an apostle, kind of silently taking notes. Here are the things that I would love to do. And then, boom, he's empowered to make many of those changes. And when you look at some of the changes, some of them appear just procedural, but turn out to also be theological, such as removing that one-year waiting period for couples to get married in the temple if they've had a civil marriage, making that uniform around the world. That's a big change. Also including women in more deeper ways in the temple and having women no longer need to promise to hearken to their husbands.
And changing that language.
Yeah, changing that language to remove the intermediary between women and God so that women can actually deal with God directly. Those are big theological changes. And so I kind of like the idea of him taking notes all that time. I was privileged very early in his presidency to just happen to be in Oakland, California, a weekend in March 2018. I think he'd been president for 2 months at that point, and he was a surprise speaker at their state conference. And that was the first time I had ever seen Nelson unplugged. You know, he spoke without any notes. Yeah. He was not freaked out by the sort of liberal ethos of the Berkeley part of the church, which is, you know, a very different mentality, perhaps. He was gracious. He was funny, which was not something I had heard in his general conference talks. That was a really neat side of him to see.
So wait, are you saying that in some ways, although you have no evidence for this,
right,
that he had in mind some kind of reform?
I think so. He often in his conference talks has used the word correct. He loves the word correct. And the idea is that there is a right way to do certain things in the church. And if we all follow that right way, things will go better.
What do you guys make of that, Patrick or Matt?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, given the dynamism and how quickly he began to initiate changes in the church. Look, he knew how old he was when he became president of the church. He didn't know how long he was going to last, but he knew he wasn't going to have a two-decade presidency. And so I think he set his mind to addressing issues that he had been thinking about. You know, there was never any sense that he was a rabble-rouser or trying to do end-arounds or some of the other things we've sometimes seen from other apostles in church history. He was as loyal could be. But there's a difference from being a leader of the church to being the leader of the church, the president of the church. I think he grasped the power of the presidency as well or better than any recent president of the church. Whether intuitively or theoretically, I mean, he just understood what it meant to be the president and prophet of the church. I think he leaned into that prophet role more than we've seen for a long time. I also think, you know, this was it was his approach as a surgeon. what do surgeons do? They find problems and they fix them. They excise them. They don't sit around theorizing about what's going on.
Yeah, you can't mess around.
You know, in the body. They don't mess around. They're decisive. They see the problem and they fix it, and then they move on to the next patient. Right? And I think he brought that sensibility. Everyone around him says how decisive he is. He's very thoughtful. He takes in information. He would do his research, but once he made up his mind, he wouldn't dither around. He would just go ahead and do it because he had a long list of other things he had to get to as well.
I think Patrick's point about him being a surgeon is really critical here. And I'd add one thing to that, right? A surgeon is in charge. A surgeon does not run an operating room through consensus building, through councils, right? Surgeons kind of seize that charismatic mantle, which, as Patrick indicates, I think is something Nelson really understood the leader of the church to be.
Matthew Bowman, he's an assistant professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. Also with us is Jana Reese, a senior columnist for Religion News Service. She's author of the book The Next Mormons. And Patrick Mason is a professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the life and legacy of LDS Church President Russell Nelson. Nelson died on Saturday. He was 101. And for a man who lived that long, he didn't seem stuck by custom or tradition. He presided over a remarkable number of reforms in an institution known for being cautious and slow to evolve. He pushed to rebrand the faith's public identity. He built a ton of temples, and he left a lasting mark on church culture. So we're talking about how Nelson shaped modern Mormonism and what to expect with a new leader. We have with us the historians and scholars Jana Reese, Patrick Mason, and Matthew Bowman. What did it mean if you were a gay Latter-day Saint, or transgender Latter-day Saint, or a person of color within the church, that Russell Nelson was your president? So think about that for a minute and kind of put a pin in that. And let's talk about what happens in 2015. Now, this is, of course, before Russell Nelson was president of the church. The church had implemented this policy that was really controversial. It restricted children of same-sex couples from becoming baptized. It labeled same-sex marriage as apostasy. And around that time, Nelson gave this talk, this address, where he described the policy this way. He said this was the mind of the Lord and the will of the Lord. He characterized it as the result of a revelatory process. He didn't say this is revelation, which is meaningful for Latter-day Saints, but he said it was a part of a revelatory process. It seemed that that's what he was trying to sort of get at. Now, the policy was later reversed in 2019, but what does that moment say about Nelson's framing of that policy and his disposition on this issue? We can talk about the fact that it changed later under his tenure, but what do you make of that particular moment? What does that say about Russell Nelson? Patrick Mason, you begin.
Yeah, I actually recently wrote an essay about this very thing for Dialogue. And it is striking to me the difference in language that he used in the two different addresses. He really believes in revelation. He believes that the church is led by revelation. And I don't second guess for a moment that he was talking sincerely in 2015 or in the months right after that, when he explained and defended the policy, when he talked about it as a revelatory event. I have full confidence that that's how he experienced it. But then he also then was in the leadership role with all of the blowback. And I don't think he would have cared about what the media said. I don't think he would have cared necessarily what the most progressive members of the church would have said. But the thing that struck me the most about when he spoke about the reversal, he specifically talked about the pain the people experienced that he heard and other leaders of the church heard. Again, he's a surgeon. He's attuned to pain. And he saw the way that this policy, I think, unintentionally, from their minds, I mean, you could have predicted it, but it just caused enormous pain within families. What do you do in response to that? I think it does create a bit of a theological conundrum. You know, if you think it's all revelation, does God change his mind on something that big within the space of three and a half years? I think he'd probably have answers for that. And you can talk about continuing revelation and so forth. But I see him as an always sincere actor, but also somebody who was listening to the church. I don't think he, you know, anybody would ever see him as the LGBTQ community's greatest ally and advocate. Mm-hmm. But he did listen, and that helped to prompt a change.
Jenna?
So I pulled up that quote. This is when President Nelson announced, well, shortly after he announced that the policy had been rescinded. He said, "The policy created concern and confusion for some and heartache for others. That grieved us. Whenever the sons and daughters of God weep, for whatever reasons, we weep. So our supplications to the Lord continued." So what he's saying there is that even though this had he had heralded it personally as the revelation of God that all of the 15 top leaders of the church had agreed on, that this was the mind of the Lord and the will of the Lord, that they continued to ask the Lord about it because people reacted so badly.
But
so
wait, couldn't it be also said that, not that this was a concession, that they had misread the mind or the will of the Lord, but could it be said that that was in fact that? We kept asking. So it sounds like what he's saying is we kept asking. What the statement seems to be saying is, I don't know, I'm probably misreading it, but maybe we got it wrong.
Well, he doesn't say that.
Yeah.
But what is really interesting, and I'll bet Patrick put this in his article, is that whereas the initial speech in early 2016 that had lauded this change as the will of the Lord, he did talk about it as a revelatory process. In the 2019 speech, he uses the word policy 10 times. The word policy never came up in the 2016 speech. So there's this de-emphasis on the idea that this was, in fact, the mind and the will of the Lord. What he does instead in 2019 is re-emphasize that the basic doctrine of the church remains that marriage is between a man and a woman and that that has not changed. He says we can adjust policy.
I would, I think, echo what my colleagues are saying here, right? He is was someone, right, who was quite decisive, someone I think who was really ready to see revelation in the deliberations of these church leaders, right? And as we listen to him talk about what revelation is and other leaders of the church talk about what revelation is, it may not always be an angel knocking on the window, right? It may sometimes be perceived simply as the agreement of these 15 people. If they all agree on something, then that must indicate, right, that the Holy Spirit is guiding them to one direction or another. His willingness, I think, to reverse this policy, which, you know, he was involved in the implementation of 3-odd years earlier, I think speaks also to his, what we mentioned earlier, to his decisiveness, his willingness to make decisions and to do things that might be perceived as upsetting the apple cart. Certainly, right, he is careful, as leaders of the church are always careful, not to say explicitly we were wrong, we're changing our minds, we're doing something different now. But he was willing to cut out foul parts of the fruit when he saw them as foul, right? Even if it may appear to do some damage to the institution along the way.
How did Russell Nelson change the experience of going to church, being at church, or the general culture of church? Your colleague Benjamin Park calls Russell Nelson the first post-pioneer prophet. And in that sense, that he seemed willing to institute ideas and reforms that leadership from another generation might not have been inclined to, that he was willing to shed those sort of cultural attachments and change the experience. So how did he change it? Jenna Reese?
Well, the two-hour block is probably the thing that he will most be remembered for in that. And also, you know, certain changes, getting rid of some of the programs and callings of the church, probably most controversially was deciding to get rid of almost all of the pageants of the church. But that's a great example of what you're talking about, because he could look at something like that and say, that's not the core of the gospel as we understand it. That is a cultural product that may or may not be relevant any longer in this day and age. So let's just get rid of those.
Ditched home teaching.
Rebranded.
Reworked, yeah. I guess some people would say he didn't at all. It's still there. I don't know. I mean, but that was that seemed remarkable, at least for a time, right?
It was. I mean, considering how much emphasis has been placed on the home teaching and visiting teaching programs in the past, to rebrand them as ministering was a really interesting decision. And, you know, that was one that I applauded. There were other decisions I was not so happy about, but that was, I thought, a very good one.
Hmm. What about the rest of you? How did he change the culture of Mormonism?
I think this idea of efficiency is one that was really close to his heart. And we mentioned that already in terms of him being a surgeon, right? He was interested in getting things done. He was less interested, I think, in the kind of cultural attachments than many Latter-day Saints might have to some of these things. I think, and as I mentioned earlier, that his real North Star here in so many ways was the global church. He could look at things like pageants, like a three-hour church block, and say, right, these things are and have been, right, pretty meaningful, I think, to people on the Wasatch Front, to people living in the kind of the world the pioneers birthed, right? This sort of a heavily Mormon
West
society.
Yeah.
But he might say, in Africa, in India, in the Philippines, pageants make little sense. Really large wards with a lot of callings don't work as well. We need to simplify. We need to trim down. We need to produce a church that is much more easily exportable to other parts of the world. And many Americans might look at some of this and see little purpose or even some pain in it. But I think he was looking to the future and to what he imagined the church might be in 100 years.
There was a phrase early in his presidency, especially in the months leading up to what became the pandemic, where he talked about home-centered and church-supported. And that was something of a reversal from, you know, mid to late 20th century, where so much of your spiritual life would have been centered on and flowing from the programs of the church. And he stripped away a lot of that. The Boy Scouts, you know, we mentioned the pageants, the youth program in general, actually, the third hour of church. So Latter-day Saints see each other on Sundays 33% less.
Wow.
And there's less going on. Already the church was moving towards streamlining weekday activities and things like that. So Latter-day Saints see each other a lot less than they used to. There's fewer opportunities to build a culture. And what he did instead, it seems to me, is to fill that hole, is to talk about temples all the time and build temples all over the world. And so you're not going to export a youth program and an activities program and pageants around the world, but you're going to export temples. And so people are going to go to church less on Sunday, but hopefully more during the week in terms of attending the temples. I think that's his vision. And then they would be studying at home, this Come Follow Me scripture study program that was implemented under him. And I actually think became quite popular among a lot of Latter-day Saints. And so that's, I think, his vision, is that you study the gospel at home, you come to church to get a little bit of juice and to take the sacrament on Sunday, and then you go to the temple at least once a month or as often as you can, and we're going to take the temples to you to make that possible for as many members of the church as possible. It's just a very different way of being a Latter-day Saint than was true in say, the mid-20th century.
What do you understand about his attention to building temples? He seemed to delight in that last, I think it was the last session of General Conference, saying, here's the 12 different temples, and they're going to be in, you know, Pacific Island nations, New Caledonia, Ghana. I mean, set aside from these other kinds of places, but they were sort of, Matthew Bowman, to your point about the sort of global attention, I suppose. But what do you make of the attention that he paid to temples? Patrick Mason, you want to get us started here?
Sure. I'd tell you a couple of things. One, I think it creates facts on the ground. It's changed a little bit in the last year or two, but especially when he became president of the church, you could have read any story about religion, and he was all about the decline of religion, disaffiliation, young people especially. Nobody's going to church anymore. And I think there's a sense of, what's the bulwark? How do you put your finger in the dike? How do you build the dam against this you know, sea of secularity? You build temples. And for him, I think that that's both very pragmatic in the sense that we're going to build this thing and create facts on the ground that we're not going away. If anything, we're going to expand our physical imprint all around the world with the hope that, you know, people are going to go into that, reinforce their spirituality. I think he clearly saw that the temple brought real spiritual power to individuals, to families, to communities, and he wanted as many people as possible to access that.
Two things to that. The first is, I think the temples, as Patrick says, are a reflection of his real optimism. Hmm. A word I use sometimes to describe all of this temple building was aspirational. That is, he wanted them to be filled. And he hoped and believed that if he and other leaders of the church could be persuasive enough to members of the church about how important temples were, people would go. Right? This is that effort idea that's really baked into, I think, a lot of his understanding of what religion was. Secondly, I think in some ways, he tried to make temples efficient as well. And this was, I think, one of the most, at least in Utah and the United States, one of the most controversial parts of his presidency, which was the real thorough renovations of the Salt Lake and the Manti Temple, designed to, I think, improve the efficiency of those buildings, to make endowments shorter. He saw the real beauty of the temple less in the kind of art and the aesthetics of it. And he saw the beauty really in covenant, in the effort that people were making to get there and the promises they were making in there.
I have been one of those people who have publicly said, why are we doing this? Why are we growing with temples so fast, so hard? In 2015, just to quantify this a bit, we had 3 temples announced. This was during the Monson presidency. Mm-hmm. We had 4 in 2016 and 5 in 2017, and then President Nelson becomes the prophet, and suddenly we're having between 30 and 35 a year. And I think it's been that way consistently every full year that he has been the president of the church. So we're that is a massive, massive increase. For me, the one that really made my eyebrows go all the way to Canada was Norway. You know, we have fewer than 4,000 members even on the books in Norway, to say nothing of how many of them are active, how many of them are temple recommend holders. But, you know, on the one hand, it seems like the church is trying to emphasize through this whole program that we are growing still, which, at least in the United States and in many parts of Europe, that's a hard proposition to defend when you look at not just the church's own data, but actually national data, census data, of how many people in those nations do say that they're Latter-day Saints. But on the other hand, this is a nod to that reality, actually, because it used to be that if an area wanted a temple, there were benchmarks. There were things they had to achieve numerically for the church to even consider building a temple in that area. All of that is out of the window, right? Let's call it the Norway approach, which is what Matt was saying, that if you build it, they will come, that the temple has become a draw factor that they're hoping will bring in more conversions.
I think Jenna's point really points to, a real shift in the church over the past 40 or 50 years. In the 1980s and 90s, when the church, you know, a lot of people said it was the fastest growing religion in the world. I'm not sure that was exactly true, but it was close. It was growing fast. The thing that people breathlessly waited for every general conference was the membership report.
Right.
Right. How many new members have there been? And then you'd do the calculations about percentages and all that. Nobody waits for the membership report anymore. Now everybody's waiting for how many temples are we building and where.
Patrick Mason. He's a professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. Also with us, Jana Reese. She's a senior columnist for Religion News Service. And Matthew Bowman is an assistant professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. LDS Church President Russell Nelson died on Saturday, so today we're talking about his life and the church under his direction. We have with us today Jana Reese, along with Patrick Mason and Matthew Bowman. Let's talk about what we know about the man who will almost certainly replace Russell M. Nelson as president of the church, barring some remarkable turn of events. What do we know about Dallin Oaks? This is a whole hour-long conversation, clearly, but Dallin Oaks is 93, if I'm not mistaken, same age as Russell Nelson when he began. So, Matthew Bowman, you begin. What are you expecting from a presidency of Dallin Oaks?
Well, I will, at risk of the same failure that I had when I predicted very little change from Nelson, I might say somewhat of the same thing here. And I say that because, of course, Oaks and Nelson were personally and professionally close. Yeah. Oaks was brought into the first presidency by Nelson. And Oaks has undoubtedly had a hand in a number of the policy shifts that Nelson has pursued. So it seems hard to me to imagine Oaks forging his own path in very large ways. I do think there are some shifts that we will see. Oaks is, I think, just in terms of personality, more cool, more lawyerly, less perhaps charismatic than Nelson turned out to be. And I do think, right, Oaks cares more about the legal issues facing the church, particularly around issues of gender, than Nelson did. I think Oaks will continue to pursue this nebulous concept of religious freedom and those meanings, I think, both in the United States, right, where the term has come, I think, to mean something of as a shorthand for issues about gender, but also internationally.
You know, I think it'll also be interesting to see if he retains Henry Eyring in the first presidency. Hmm. By all accounts, his health is not great. Yeah. And so would he preserve him? It might be hard to demote him, you know, after serving in two consecutive first presidencies. I'll just say more broadly about President Oaks. Yeah. And who we expect to be the church president, I completely agree with Matt. I think he is wired to be more concerned about public square issues than President Nelson was. I know that a lot of people are worried that that means that he's going to be a culture warrior. And it is true that over the years, he had been one of, if not the most outspoken voice on the church's public square issues, especially around gender and sexuality, same-sex marriage, etc. I perceive, and I could be wrong, and it could just be me, that in the last few years, I see not that Oaks has given in at all in terms of his beliefs about church doctrine and church teaching, but that his approach to the public square has really been less of a culture warrior and more of a peacemaker. I think he drank the President Nelson Kool-Aid. Huh. And he has this great line, I call it the Oaks Doctrine, where he says, on contested issues, we should seek to moderate and to unify. I think he really believes that. So I think that, yes, he will probably be more engaged in the public square as the church president than President Nelson was, but I don't think he's going to approach it as a culture warrior.
Two things that I'm looking at as we are on the cusp of a Dallin Oaks presidency. One is how he will deal with rising political and social polarization, because like you, Matt, I do see this as a theme in his talks, especially in recent years. Hmm. When he said Latter-day Saints accept the results of elections, for example, yeah. That was a fairly pointed remark. You know, he is not going to come out and deliberately tell people to vote one way or the other. But I think he is going to emphasize process. He's going to emphasize checks and balances. And certainly he will emphasize in this country the importance of the Constitution. So that's the first thing that I'm going to be looking for. Mm-hmm. The other is he has in conjunction with that historical emphasis on gender and sexuality questions, he has in recent general conferences been very concerned to get people married and having children. And certainly, from a statistical standpoint, I can absolutely understand where he's coming from. Religion will thrive best when people have families. And when people are not necessarily having families at all, to say nothing of the large families of the LDS past, that is a concern for our vital future.
Unlike quite a few of his predecessors, and this is kind of ironic, Russell M. Nelson, who made it to 101, didn't seem to have been as afflicted by the drawbacks of age as some of his, you know, predecessors. I mean, he had to, you know, deliver some of his speeches sitting down there in the end, couldn't make it to as many of the, you know, sort of typical duties and events. But he did seem mentally, you know, cognitively vital until he died, which I wonder what you made of that. That does seem like an exception in the church. And that I just wonder what you make of that, because there's often this sort of critique about the church being this gerontocracy and that it's being governed by these very old people. And here was a very old person who seemed fairly vital there until the end.
It was an interesting contrast just with the person who preceded him, President Monson,
right,
because toward the end of President Monson's tenure, he was cognitively having trouble, and it was visible. So that was an interesting contrast. That vitality of President Nelson continued right up until the very end. In fact, just 3 weeks ago, he penned a beautiful piece for Time magazine about peacemaking and encouraging people to lay down their weapons of war. And in the last 24 hours, I've been thinking about that quite a bit as we've been looking at the news about this horrific shooting in Michigan at an LDS church there. And not just that, but the rise of religious violence more generally. So violence against other Christians, Jews, Muslims in this country, Sikhs in this country, all of that is of concern. And I think that he was enough of a humanitarian rather than just a tribalist to be able to say all of those religions should be protected. All of those people are innocent people who should not be victims of violence. And all of us need to work together to solve the problem.
So how is he going to be remembered, do you think, in the end, in 20 years, I guess, you know, when it all settles out, what will stand out? Is it that he sort of drew the church out of a kind of hidebound tradition-based structure to something more progressive and efficient, allowed the church to reform without changing its principles, built a lot of temple. Like, what in the end? What rises to the top for you, Patrick Mason? You go first.
A couple of things. One, at least if he has his way, it will be a more temple-centered religion moving forward. I do think he will be remembered historically as somebody who opened our collective minds and at least raised the question about what is Mormonism or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for the long haul. The more we put the pioneer experience in the rearview mirror, what is this thing in a rapidly changing world? And what is it going to look like? What are the essentials that need to be and will be carried? And then how much can you change the packaging? And then I'll just say on one level, what a hope of mine is that his message of peacemaking, that becomes central to his legacy and that really becomes embedded in the church. I think the talk that he gave, Peacemakers Needed, I hope and pray that we'll be studying that talk 10 years, 20 years, 100 years from now.
Matthew Bowman.
Yeah, I will echo something Patrick had said earlier on. We remember Joseph F. Smith as sort of the great modernizer for the 20th century. Nelson, I think, will be remembered as a modernizer too, but to a very different modernity, a more global modernity, a modernity in which these large institutional churches have less power and less sway. I don't think he accomplished ultimately the kind of transformation of his church into an institution that might thrive or survive in that sort of world, but he began the process of shifting this church from that large, lumbering mid-20th century institution into something smaller, more personal, more streamlined.
Jana Reese, final word.
I think President Nelson will be remembered for his vitality and his optimism. That may not seem like much in terms of the doctrine or the changing nature of the church, both of which are very important. But he set an example as someone who greeted life in a particular way, but tremendously disciplined. I read in one of his obituaries that he weighed himself daily and that if he had gone up by so much as a pound, he would go on a diet, which, I'm sorry, that sounds kind of compulsive to me. But the optimism, looking at the future and not necessarily being a grumpy elderly person who is always thinking that things were better in the past.
That's the journalist and historian Jana Reese. She's a senior columnist for Religion News Service, author of the book The Next Mormons. Also with us, Patrick Mason. He's a professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. And Matthew Bowman. He's the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies and an assistant professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1, on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.